This episode is part of our ongoing series with Queen's University Belfast, where we have the chance to sit down with an interesting student, professor, or graduate once a month to hear and share their story. To find out more and see the other episodes as part of this series, please visit bestofbelfast.org/Queens. Thanks so much for being here, and I really hope you enjoy this week's conversation.
I have a vague memory, and this could be those memories that aren't yours, but because so many people have told you about them that they become yours.
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it?
Isn't it? Of being in a cot by my parents, by my mum's bed at home. Wow. And standing up, and I don't know why I should remember that, because it's not something that your parents would necessarily tell you. I remember the time you were in a cot. I mean, but gosh, isn't it funny how little we remember of our early years? I mean, I say that having had two children and watched them grow up, and the effort that you put in as a parent in those, not just early years, but, you know, throughout. And do I remember much that happened to me before, I don't know, 7 or 8?
Yeah.
Not a great deal.
Yeah, it is interesting, though, you know, what you were saying. You've got us at a good time. We just celebrated our daughter's first birthday. And we did kind of have that moment where you have to check yourself. You're thinking, you know, who's this party really for?
right. Yeah.
Where did you call home? Where was you kind of born and bred, though?
So grew up in Glengormley, which, awesome. As many of your listeners will know, is a sort of, I'll call it, I hope I'm not insulting anybody, a suburb of Belfast. I mean, it's, you know, 4 miles north of the city centre. And, you know, it was a village then. It wasn't really a suburb of Belfast, I suppose, and it was called the village. And near my house there was a playground and a football field and tennis courts. So you know, I used to go there a lot, and my mum was good enough to let me, you know, go down the street and meet my friends in the park at a very early age, something probably that parents wouldn't do now. And then I went to school on the Antrim Road, so I got the bus every day and, you know, tootled down to primary school and came back, and then went to school further down the Antrim Road near Carlisle Circus, you know, also on the bus. So, yes, through North Belfast and up to Glengormley was my stomping ground.
And so, you know, at that age, alongside no doubt wanting to be a professional footballer, did media and journalism ever, was it even remotely on your radar? Did you
not
have an experience at looking at someone on TV and thinking, oh, that looks kind of cool?
Not for a moment. Not for a second. I mean, yes, like a lot of little boys, you know, football was, you know, one thing. The only thing, I mean, looking back on it, when the trouble started, I was 10 or 9, depending on when you want to date the start of the troubles. And the radio was always on in our house for a number of reasons. Number one, you know, my mum had it on just to keep her company. Sure. But also in those days, you know, the radio was on because you had to hear the news. Mm. You know, it was really vital to know, was there peace in your area? Had anyone you knew been killed? You know, what was the troubles like? You know, so when I was, 69, I was 10. The radio was always on. And looking back on it, I suppose I the news was therefore always an important thing in my mind. But no, I had no clue that I wanted to be a journalist. In fact, that continued until I graduated from Queen's.
Wow.
So I didn't really, even right through university, I had no thought about being a journalist. In fact, the only thing I thought about was acting, and I was a member of the Queen's Drama Society. In fact, along with a couple of other people, we refounded the Drama Society at Queen's. I was a member of the Lyric Youth Theatre. We did some plays. I worked with a very charismatic director called Sam McCready.
I loved to his wife Joan recently.
Right,
another project we were doing.
Okay, fine woman and a wonderful man and a very charismatic guy. In fact, sadly, so charismatic that when he left us to direct plays off Broadway, the Lyric Drama Studio kind of fell apart. And that was the point where I realized, oh dear, you know, I don't have a scholarship to RADA. I can't get into East 15. I need to make some money here because I had a flat near the university, which I wanted to keep on, and I had to earn some money. So yeah, that's when my thoughts turned to what am I going to do now that I've got this degree?
Fantastic. That's an excellent place to park. Let me just jump in here. Yeah, so look, if you have just been listening so far, welcome to Best of Belfast, the podcast that celebrates Northern Ireland and the incredible people in it. Joined today with the wonderful Bill Neely. And just a little bit about Bill, a little bit of context just before we pick up where we left off. Bill is a three-time BAFTA winner. He's also an Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist with over 40 years of experience, most recently as NBC's chief global correspondent. And you're the master of transitions, like I joked with you before, Bill, because today's episode is also the first in our new series with Queen's University, who you've already brought up. And that series is where we will be sharing a conversation with an interesting student, a graduate, or a professor each month. And Bill, you've just recently become the recipient of the sought-after Graduate of the Year from Queen's, so congratulations as well.
Thank you very much. I was gobsmacked when I got the call.
It's amazing. Lovely. Really fascinating. And so, you know, just to pick up kind of where we left off, take us back to, you know, those university days. If Wikipedia is right, it's 1977 modern history and English literature, but I'll lean to you to fill in the blanks there.
Yeah, that's right. I loved my time at Queen's. I mean, I really, I had thoughts when I was upper sixth of going to, you know, Durham or Edinburgh or somewhere else. But I think, to be quite frank, in the end, I had offers, but I didn't have the courage to go. So I went to Queen's. I studied in my first year English, French, and history, which were the three subjects I took for A level. I loved them all. I was offered honours and took joint honours in English and history. And by and large, I loved all of the courses and just adored my time there. I was pretty studious. I mean, I had a good time as well, but I loved the work. I loved the literature and the history. I came from a all boys primary school and all boys grammar school, and then suddenly I was in tutorials and lectures with girls. It was just, yeah, the whole thing was terrific.
A whole new world.
brave new world. So yeah, I acted a bit. What else? You know, did all the usual student things. Had a flat with friends. Had a flat on my own. Made lots of friendships. Many of which I still have today. Loved some of the tutors and lecturers that I had. And yeah, the only thing was then I wasn't great about thinking about how I was going to use my degree. It was also 1981, and it was one of those low points in employment. I mean, the economy in Northern Ireland was bad throughout the Troubles, obviously, but in 1981, it was the year of the hunger strikes. There weren't many jobs around. In fact, I think when I graduated, I think the statistic that I remember was that only one in eight of us had a job to go to.
Wow.
So I ended up going along to the Queen's Career Service for the first time and saying, hi, you don't know me and I don't know what I want to do, but I'm just introducing myself. And the lovely woman in there said, well, funnily enough, the BBC are looking for people to fill in for the summer. So this was June 1981. The hunger strikes were on. The place was in chaos. There were lots of broadcasters around, both from London and abroad, that the BBC was required, BBC Northern Ireland was required to help, and they needed more hands on deck. So the woman said, look, why don't you go along? And so I did, and it was essentially, I suppose, an internship. I went along to BBC Radio Current Affairs, and after a day of showing me around and showing me a tape recorder, they said, look, if you can record some stuff on this, do interviews or whatever, we'll pay you. You know, you'll get a fee for it. And that's how it started. And I started with two other people. a guy called Fergus Keeling, who went on to be the director, I believe it was the director of programs for BBC Northern Ireland. Incredible. And Conor Bradford, who was a broadcaster, it still may be, for the BBC. And the three of us kind of started at the same time. And that's how it all began. And after a while, I just thought, wow, this is quite fun. One of the first interviews I did was with Kevin Keegan, who was then, you know, one of the great footballers in England, and really enjoyed. He was running around the Mary Peters track. Fantastic. I can't remember what the story was, apart from the fact that I was trying to keep up with him and record an interview on a reel-to-reel tape recorder at the same time. So yeah, that's how I fell into, and I really did. I am the accidental journalist. I just started to think, actually, this is fun, and they're paying me for it, so why not just keep going?
Mm. And even when you were talking about the radio being on, you know, in your mum's house, it just kind of made me think that you came into the industry at a time where there was such a sense of urgency. You know, nowadays, yeah, if you miss the 6 o'clock news, you're like, oh, I'll get it on social media.
Correct.
Or I'll get it on the app or whatever. Whereas, you know, it was very time sensitive, and it was must have been a very, very high pressure, but also very exciting career to just all of a sudden jump into.
Yeah, it was. And you got the sense, therefore, that it really, really mattered. Mm. Not just the news that you would deliver, but the way you would deliver it. And, you know, one of the first lessons I learned was that words can actually kill. If you get something wrong in a news report and you attribute blame to one group or another group or to one, you know, group of lads on a street, and you say, you know, they threw stones and the bus crashed and that's why those people died, you know, that can result in retaliation for which you might be responsible. Wow. You know, it was a tinderbox, and therefore you had to be very careful how you behaved, what you said, and especially what you said in your reports. You know, facts matter. They mattered then, and they certainly matter today.
So, I mean, what were some of the earlier, more sensitive stories that you would have been a part of sharing and communicating?
Well, the first story that I could honestly say was a real breakthrough story for me in so many ways was the Droppin' Well explosion in Ballykelly, in which, gosh, how many was it? I should know. 18 people died. I think there were 11 soldiers from the Cheshire Regiment, and the rest were local civilians. And I was working for Radio Current Affairs at that time, and I remember the explosion went off in the evening. I got up there in my not very fast Mini, and was there quickly enough to be just in among debris that was still, you could still see the dust rising from the debris, and basically spent most of the night there, or I might have grabbed some sleep, and spent the rest of the week there covering the story of those who died. And I remember at one point feeling that I was so exhausted that I couldn't go on, and that, of course, is a familiar thing for a journalist, but it was the first time I'd really encountered it, just exhaustion. And the second thing I remember at the end of that was going back to my B&B or a hotel room anyway, and just sitting on the bed. I think it was on the Friday after one of the funerals. So my work week had effectively finished. Mm. And I sat on the bed, and I wept like a baby. I suddenly burst out crying, and I couldn't, this had never happened to me before, and I couldn't work out what's going on. But it was just all that pent up emotion, all the pressure of the work. So I was working for Good Morning Ulster, I was working for PM Ulster, and being required therefore to produce, you know, 4 or 5 minutes radio every morning, every evening. And then finally realizing that it was done and just letting go. Mm. So to answer your question, that's honestly the first really profound experience. I had, and obviously it was one of the worst episodes of The Troubles as well. So it has really stuck with me.
So, you know, kind of on that then, I think there are really two options for someone who's in that situation. You know, you're new to the industry. You could have walked away from that experience and said, nope, this isn't for me. I've had a traumatic experience. It's affected me greatly. What was it that made you seemingly double down and keep going down that path?
I suppose ultimately because I loved telling those stories. I mean, that sounds a terrible thing, but that's what journalists do. You know, we work in the worst situations, in wars, in earthquakes, to tell some stories. And I do remember telling the story of one of the family of one of the girls who died, and being tremendously moved by the family's story of her and their desire to have her story out, to make her life more meaningful than her death in the rubble of the Droppin Well. And so simply getting stories out are important. I mean, one of the greatest moments of Northern Ireland journalism was when after the Enniskillen bombing, the father of one of the victims not only agreed to give an interview to journalists, but forgave the killers of his daughter. Wow. And that story and his need and desire to make that gesture would never have been possible had a journalist not knocked on his door. So although the worst part of our job as journalists in Northern Ireland during the Troubles was knocking on the door of the bereaved relatives of a victim and saying, look, I'm so sorry, I'm Bill Neely from the BBC, I'm sorry about your loss. And genuinely, you know, we were mortified at that point and genuinely sorry. And, you know, is there anything you want to say? You know, I've got a tape recorder here. Do you want to give an interview? Do you want to make any kind of a statement? Wow. So those were both the worst moments, but sometimes they produced the most extraordinary stories or interviews or just, you know, moments like I forgive my daughter's killers. So yes, I chose not to walk away that week. I mean, earlier in the week, I was so exhausted that I think I told the producer, the editor of the program, that I just don't have the energy to do this piece. And she said, you know, come on, you can do it. And I, you know, gathered up my energy and did it. So, you know, that there are stories like that, that and I suppose moments like that in every career that are critical.
Yeah, the power of uncomfortable conversations really is massive, isn't it?
Yeah.
What brought you out of Northern Ireland then?
So I suppose I had always wanted to leave Northern Ireland, really, and experience the big wide world. I also felt after 6 years of journalism in Northern Ireland that what I was doing was, so I went from radio current affairs to radio news to television news, and began to feel that there was a sameness about what I was doing. So it was mostly covering daily violence. Mm-hmm. And there came to be a formula that you would use. This is rather crude, but what it came down to was the bomb exploded at X time. X number of people were injured. X number of people were killed. The attack's been condemned by, and then you went through the litany of the politicians who were condemning it, and so on. It became formulaic, and there was an accepted formula, and you really didn't stray from that. And I felt that very limiting after a while, and I felt I just wanted to do other things. I also happened to meet an English girl, she had been also a journalist at the BBC in Belfast, and then she moved back to London. So there was a, you know, there was a romantic reason, the heartstrings, a romantic reason to leave as well. But yeah, that's why. So I got an attachment to BBC Breakfast Time, and worked the early morning show for, you know, 2 years after that.
Wow. And this is a bit crude from myself here as well, but do you think that the experience that you were able to have early on in your career in Northern Ireland did set you up or open doors for you down the line?
Definitely. It was a hugely positive experience. I mean, I think at the beginning, when you move as a reporter from a region, especially with an accent like like mine, or it could be Scotland or you know, Birmingham, or there was certainly in those days a more than a bit of prejudice in, you know, metropolitan trendy London and among BBC managers, who were by and large, you know, white male, middle class, middle aged, and very English.
Yes.
But most of them, and I remember some of them were pretty nasty, really, about people from the regions. So in one sense, it was a disadvantage leaving your sort of safe zone and going into national broadcasting. But I think the more important thing is that grounding in Northern Ireland, in covering hugely important stories, important for the people who live there, for the nation of Northern Ireland, but the greater, you know, UK, and some of them had worldwide significance, of course, not least, you know, the hunger strikes, which was the first thing on my radar in 1981. So, you know, carrying the experience of, you know, being in riots, coming upon what you could only call a massacre, you know, chaos and confusion, you know, arriving at an event just minutes after something horrific has happened. All of that stood me in good stead later on when I came to cover, you know, wars, civil unrest anywhere, civil wars, and obviously just even, you know, things like natural disasters, where you're pitched into a country you don't know or a place you don't know, and there's just confusion all around you. So hugely important. And I think that's one reason why, you know, there have been a lot of broadcasters who've covered Northern Ireland and from Northern Ireland who've been incredibly successful. I mean, I think of good colleague and great friend of mine, Johnny Irvine, for ITN, you know, and of course, plenty of national broadcasters down the years who cut their teeth in Northern Ireland. Martin Bell, for example, a great hero of mine in the broadcasting sense, you know, who cut his teeth in Ballymurphy in 1970-71.
When was your first real overseas deployment, which probably isn't the right word to use, but it's the one that's come to mind, you know, and what was that like for you? Because you, as you said, you were in Northern Ireland your whole life, and then, you know, you moved across the water, but it is a very different experience going to London than it is going to, you know, somewhere where you don't speak the language, completely different climate, completely different culture. So what was it like for you to start to experience some of that?
Funnily enough, the first foreign story I did was with BBC Radio Ulster, and it was in Naples. Wow. Belfast and Naples had just been given a status by the European Union as, you know, way down the league of everything, and therefore in need of help. And we went to Naples to compare, just to give people an idea of what the city was like. So we did I think it was a 1 hour radio documentary, and we met members of the Camorra, who are the Neapolitan mafia, which was just absolutely fascinating. So that was actually, to be truthful, that was the first foreign story I did. But deployment, yeah, different things. So I had a couple of forays with BBC Breakfast Time, including during the Iran-Iraq war, but that was just on a warship with the British, with the Royal Navy in the Straits of Hormuz. And it wasn't really then until I joined ITN in 1989 that I became a proper kind of what I by then really, really wanted to do, which is be a foreign correspondent. And 1989 was, of course, an astonishing year because you not only had Tiananmen Square, but you had the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe and in November, the fall of the Berlin Wall. So I was employed by ITN in July 89. And in November 89, they pitched me in to Berlin. And I found myself in West Berlin covering the most astonishing story that any of us had ever seen, and it still remains to this day probably the biggest story in a sense that I've ever covered, because it just had such worldwide implications. And so, you know, for 2 weeks I was in Berlin. I mean, luckily, no, I don't speak German, but enough people spoke English, and it was such a rapturous atmosphere, just absolutely extraordinary. It's hard to recall how much of a surprise the fall of the Berlin Wall was today, because it's just part of history. And oh yeah, it was built in 61 and it fell in 89. And yeah, but nobody saw it coming. Yeah. And when I got on a plane and landed in Berlin, I couldn't believe my eyes. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And nor could any of us who were privileged enough to be there that day and that night and the subsequent days and nights. Just astonishing.
Absolutely. Something that I think I'm going to keep coming back to, because it's a source of personal interest for myself. You know, I'm sitting here in a studio with a microphone and a recorder that frankly delivers just about as good audio quality as you can get. And it cost me a couple of £100 and it fits in my backpack. It runs on A4 batteries.
Yeah.
And, you know, so even if you take us back to the Berlin Wall, like the sheer technical challenges that must have been involved of recording stuff and sending it back to the station and making sure it all made it there. Like, what sort of equipment were you even using at this time?
Yeah. So just to take it back a few years. So at the BBC in Belfast, I started on film. So it was a cameraman with a film camera, and there was, you know, whatever it was, can't remember, 800 feet of film in the camera. It wasn't endless. And he, and it usually was a he, you know, started and stopped the camera when he really needed to. Wow. You just didn't press the button and let it roll. So it also meant that the journalist, you know, for example, when you were doing an interview, or especially when you were doing a piece to camera, you know, when you were speaking to the camera, you damn well had to get that right. You know, it was one take, maximum two, or you were in trouble. And there was no messing around with 20-minute interviews. I mean, forget that. So that imposed a great discipline on us. And then, of course, the film had to go back. And sometimes it was lost in processing, because the film had to go into a vat of chemicals. And sometimes, you know, the chemicals ruined it. And you were told, you know, your report won't be going out because we lost the film, or there was a hair on the gate. So there was a little hair just in front of the lens, and, you know, it was wiggling and all of those things. So, and then when we moved to electronic news gathering, as it was called, ENG in those days, you know, the pieces of equipment that we used to carry onto a plane and take off a plane were massive, you know, the editing machines and so on. So it was physically very tough. You know, if you landed in a place, the first thing you had to do was hump the gear. Get the gear off the plane. It wasn't rush off and start doing interviews. No, you know, you were a team. I mean, sometimes you were a team of two, but you might, if you were lucky, you were a team of four. And yeah, so things have changed. And then at the end of it, you know, when you've done your television piece, you've got to the scene, you've done your interviews, you've come back, you've edited it, you've voiced it. Then you had to get to a TV station and you had booked a satellite. And sometimes that was done on a fax machine or a telex machine. I remember from my days in Moscow, a telex machine, book space. And then, you know, you had a 10-minute window to send it from a TV station, which you had to get into past the security guards. And sometimes that was very difficult in, you know, Moscow or Baghdad or Smolensk or wherever you happen to be.
Absolutely.
So, gosh, yes, things have changed so much.
you just have, I imagine that like we could talk for 2 or 3 hours about some of the stories and the experiences that you have been fortunate mm-hmm. enough to be a part of. There are a couple though that I'd love for you to humor me with.
Go on.
And tell me about being arrested on the US presidential campaign trail.
Ah, I thought you might bring that up. so 1992, I was the Washington correspondent and bureau chief for ITN. I mean, I was 31 years old, you know, huge responsibility, and I was covering my first presidential election campaign. And I went, so the one of the first big events is the New Hampshire primary. And George Bush Sr. was being challenged from within the Republican Party by a man called Pat Buchanan. So there was Clinton and his gang fighting for the Democrat nomination. And President George Bush was being challenged from within. Huge story. I contacted the Buchanan campaign. And on a Saturday night, he was doing a rally in a place called Nashua, New Hampshire. And I said, look, when Pat has finished the speech and everything, I want to do an interview with him. They said, absolutely fine. I had credentials around my neck, given by the Secret Service, by the way. You were vetted very thoroughly. So I had, you know, White House reporter, ITN, Bush campaign, or Buchanan campaign, all these badges strung around my neck. Huge crowd Saturday night. Buchanan is coming out of a very, very tight entrance, and we're there with the camera along with other journalists. And there's a huge crowd there, and the crowd surges forward sort of towards us and towards the entrance of the hall. Pat Buchanan's coming out, and there are people shouting, get back, get back, get back. And I'm there with my microphone, and it continues, and Buchanan is about, I don't know, 10 feet from me, and he's seen me, and we've made eye contact, and the camera is rolling, and suddenly I feel a hand on my shoulder, and I'm dragged backwards. And I look behind, and I shout, White House press, White House press. You know, I have an interview.
Yeah.
And another hand grabs me. And anyway, long story short, it was two Nashua, New Hampshire police officers who thought I was disobeying their order to get back. We were where all the journalists normally are, in a kind of, you know, press area, as it were. And these guys had just thought, the only thing I need to do is clear the way, so I'm going to grab this journalist. Mm. So I was dragged away. I was handcuffed.
Oh, my goodness.
I was brought to a cell. I had my belt taken, shoelaces taken. In I went. And they said, we are charging you with failing to obey the orders of a police officer. And a couple of hours later, they came in, they took me out of the cell, and they said, we're going to charge you with two more things. And that is, what was the second one? Anyway, the third one was assaulting a police officer, resisting arrest.
What?
And assaulting a police officer. And I said, absolutely not. On all three counts, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut a very long story short, we went to trial.
They went all the way to trial?
All the way to trial.
Are you serious?
I had video of exactly what happened. I had audio of what happened. I had photographs from the Philadelphia Inquirer and from another local newspaper. I had character witnesses flown across the Atlantic by ITN and local radio and photographers who were prepared to be in court. So I had 12 witnesses. I had audio and I had video. And one by one, my lawyer said, we really think you should plead guilty to the first one. They're throwing these two other charges at you in order to get you guilty on number one. And I said, I'm going to fight it all the way. I did none of these things. I had a right to be there and blah, 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 blah. One by one, the lawyer came across and they said, okay, prosecution's prepared to drop the charge of assaulting a police officer as long as you plead guilty to resisting arrest and failing to obey that. I said, nope, we're going to go to trial. So he goes back and he consults and he comes back and he says, okay, they're prepared to drop resisting arrest but you must plead guilty to the first charge. I said, no, we're going to go into court and do this. So he went back And he came back to me and he said, look, this is really unusual. They've decided to drop all the charges on condition that you don't sue the police officers. So I said, that's absolutely fine. So I signed whatever I had to sign and off we went and had a jolly good lunch.
Crazy. Isn't it sad that it had to go that far?
Yes, it is. And that, I'm afraid that is the American legal system. And it, again, all of these things teach you a lot. And that taught me for a long time to come about criminal justice in America.
I mean, I guess like from an outside perspective, there does seem to be a general hostility towards journalists. Like, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it was explained to me afterwards. I mean, Nashua, New Hampshire was in those days quite a right-wing state. It certainly had pockets of right-wing support. And I understood at that time that Nashua was one of them. So, and I think, you know, to be fair to the two police officers, by the way, whose stories never added up, they were faced with a sudden situation of a presidential candidate being swamped by a crowd. Yeah. And they felt they were suddenly out of control and they panicked. So, you know, look, they were doing their job and I was trying to do mine, but they came down like a ton of bricks and invented things, which is never right.
Crazy. So then completely shift of gear then. talk to us about almost being killed while carrying a national beauty queen to safety.
So that was a funny story. At least I think it was funny.
It sounds hilarious.
could have ended badly. So I spent a lot of time covering the war in Kosovo. And I was very, very fortunate to have a wonderful local, what we call fixer, a sort of local producer who does everything for you in a sense, from booking a car if you need one to getting you to the front line of a war. They speak the language, obviously. And so I had a wonderful woman called Evliana Barani. And one day she said to me, look, the day after next, I cannot work with you because I've made a commitment to work with Japanese television for a couple of days, but I will get someone for you. In fact, it's a very, very good and old friend of mine. I said, absolutely fine, Evliana. If you recommend this person, then that's good enough for me. But every day we were covering really bad things. I mean, you know, mass killings. It was war. It was war. So the morning came when Evliana's replacement turned up and I went down to our armored vehicle. We had a big 4-ton armored vehicle and my cameraman and driver were there. And this woman, absolutely drop dead gorgeous woman, turned up and she said, you know, hi, are you Bill? And I said, yes. And she said, I'm Aphrodite. And her name was Aphrodite Pacharada, so Aphrodite. Wow. And she was, in fact, Miss Kosovo. And she looked it. I mean, she was beautiful. And so in the side mirrors of the armored vehicle, she was doing her makeup before we set off for a war zone. Anyway, so about an hour and a half later, we were in a very dangerous place called Terpeje. And as often happens when you're unlucky, we stayed in one location a little bit too long and we were mortared. They had seen something on a tripod, which in fact was a camera, and they'd seen movement. And these were the Yugoslav forces, really the Serb forces. And they decided to shell us. And when you're shelled, it's a very, very frightening experience. So Evliana, who was a beauty queen, wasn't used to anything like this. And we ran for it, but she was wearing platform shoes. So almost immediately she twisted her ankle. And the shells kept landing and my cameraman had gone a different way. And we knew where the car was, but it's one thing, you know, to know where something is and another thing to try and get to it. So by this stage, Miss Kosovo was absolutely in hysterics. Her ankle was swelling up. She couldn't walk, but we had to get away. So I carried her. In fact, it turned out one of her ankles was broken and the other one was twisted.
My goodness.
And she was just in pieces. But we did, fortunately, that we escaped the shelling, and I suppose 6 or 7 shells had fallen very close to us. We got back to the vehicle, and ITN, being the decent employer that it always is and always was, paid her for the next 6 months because she couldn't work.
Wow.
So she worked for about 5 hours for me, for us, and we paid her for 6 months. But she took it, I mean, she took it very well. Obviously, she was in extreme pain, and she was very, very frightened by the experience. But yeah. So not to be repeated by her. And
yeah. Crazy. Absolutely crazy. How long were you with ITN?
25 years.
Incredible.
Yeah. And then I had an offer of I was very happy there. I mean, I was Washington correspondent for 5 years. I was Europe correspondent. Sorry, Washington correspondent for 6 years, Europe correspondent for 5 years. And then I was international editor. Until I received an offer from NBC, the American broadcaster, to become its chief global correspondent. And that was just too good a sort of opportunity to pass up. It was, you know, I suppose I'd settled into a bit of a comfort zone, and it was a new challenge, and it was, you know, to an American audience, and you know, I had experience of America. I'd lived there, and I just thought this is too good an opportunity to pass up. So yeah, but 25 years at ITN were just wonderful.
And I mean, did you ever imagine winning a BAFTA or winning an Emmy? I mean, it's just unbelievable. Isn't it?
No. You don't, because you just do the job to the best of your ability. Yeah. I mean, when you've done something really great, you think, wow, that was, you know, that could win some kind of award, you know, and the Royal Television Society obviously is the one that, you know, that you all hope for. But a BAFTA just seemed out of beyond belief, out of reach, and an Emmy as well. So yeah, to have won both of those is still fantastic.
Which one of those 4 trophies are you most proud of? And the story connected behind it.
Gosh. Well, I won the Emmy and one of the BAFTAs for the same assignment, which was the Beishuan earthquake in China in 2008. I think that's right. And yet, ironically, it was the story that I did least to get. Mm. So we had been in China for almost a week, and I was coming back from somewhere else. And I said to the crew, let's just pop into this refugee camp one more time. We've been there already. Let's just see if anything has changed. It'll only take 20 minutes. And we arrived, and a woman came up to me in the camp, and said, my partner has just shot, has a video. Would you be interested in seeing it? And this was through a translator, and I said to the translator, just ask her what's on the video, because we probably need to go. And the woman said, it's the earthquake pretty much from the moment that it started, and the camera keeps rolling for an hour. So I said, okay, well, let's have a look at this. So we took the tape and we put it in. I gave it to my editor, who was in the edit van. And I went back to the camp and I just said to him, just have a look at this and tell me what you think of it. I came back about 20 minutes later, and he said to me, you will never believe what's on this. And it was literally the moment when the dust cleared and you could see people's faces through a haze.
Wow.
And the cameraman then went through the city of Beishuan, just filming scene after scene after scene. And that was it. We put that together in an 8-minute edit. I did a piece to camera among the survivors of Beishuan. And that was it. So ironically, the story that I won a BAFTA and an Emmy for was probably the story that I personally and my cameraman did the least amount of work for. But look, you know, there's so much of journalism and life, which is to do with luck. And I've been blessed in my career to have quite a bit of it, chiefly to have survived a lot of the things that I went through and saw, where I know others, including close friends, did not survive. Mm. So that's luck. That's big slice of luck number one. And then there are other slices of luck that give you, you know, rewards that you never expected. But I suppose that's the story that has the most awards attached to it.
Crazy, man. Absolutely crazy. This one's probably a bit left field, but I'm going to ask it anyway. why is Sir Ian McKellen your favourite actor?
So that dates to my attempts to be an actor before I became a journalist. So I was at Queen's. I was in the Lyric Drama Studio, and it was 1980, if I'm not mistaken. And Ian McKellen came to Belfast to do a two-hander, him and another actress. And I went along to see it with my then girlfriend. And they were both brilliant. And, you know, actors and actresses just didn't come to Belfast in those days. Nothing came to Belfast, you know, no orchestras, no plays, nothing. But he came. And my girlfriend and I decided to go backstage afterwards, and she pushed me to pluck up the courage to ask him to come the next day to our rehearsals on Cromwell Road off Botanic Avenue, where we rehearsed in a church hall. And we just thought, wouldn't it be brilliant just to meet him? And here's an excuse to go backstage and meet him. So he led us into the dressing room. We told him who we were, Lyric Drama Studio, you know, there'd be about 20 people rehearsing and we'd love him to come along if he had the time, blah, 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 blah. And we left. And he was charming, lovely. And I thought, wow, met Ian McKellen. That was fantastic. There is no way in the world the guy's going to turn up. At 2 o'clock the next day, through the door of the church hall, walks in Ian McKellen.
Wow.
And I mean, I saw him. Other people were just sort of rooted to the spot. A few people knew exactly who he was, but mouths had dropped and there was a kind of silence. And we went forward to say hello. And I said, I can't believe you've come. This is just unbelievable. Thank you so much. And for the next, I'd say almost 4 hours, he gave us his time. And he was rehearsing himself to play Macbeth in London. And he said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I will do how I approach a couple of speeches. And he did the famous Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow speech from Macbeth. And he said, I'm still trying this out. So, you know, you can be my sounding board as well. But here's how I approach a great set piece speech like this. And he proceeded to give us at least an hour on that speech. It was just dazzling. And for a guy like him to come to, you know, a group of late teens and early 20s wannabe actors and actresses and give us his time for nothing in a city that was in turmoil, I've never forgotten it. And I had the pleasure of reminding him when I saw him in London once of what he'd done, and he was slightly embarrassed and said, oh yes, yeah, I'm not even sure he remembered it, but no, I have a special place in my heart for Ian McKellen. And actually just a few weeks ago I went to see him playing Hamlet at his advanced age. He's well into his 80s and he was still as wonderful as ever. A generous, decent man, just wonderful. So yeah, I have many favorite actors, but boy, he's right up there.
So incredible.
Yeah.
And I mean, for yourself now, like moving into this next season of your life, like what are some of the things pressing on you that you'd like to turn your time and your attention to?
Do you know, at the minute, so I stopped working for NBC in April and I decided that I was just going to take at least 6 months out. I was not even going to think about next step or, and in fact, I feel after 40 years, maybe is, you know, I did say it's time to hang up the microphone and I think I'm done with daily news. Mm. You know, it requires enormous physical effort. It requires, you know, at NBC, I would get on a plane in London, fly overnight to South Korea, start working straight away. You're lucky if you got a few hours sleep on the plane and then just keep going early morning, late night interviews, doing lives. It really is draining. And it wasn't that I wasn't up to it, but I come to the conclusion that maybe I've done that now. So at the minute, I am just hugely enjoying not working. I am doing a lot of, I run marathons and I do triathlons and 10Ks and half marathons and stuff. So I'm doing, I build my day around training. So I do whatever, you know, a long run or a long bike ride or a mile swim or a yoga session or whatever. And so I build my day around that. I'm really, really enjoying that. I read books. I'm trying to learn about the financial world because I have a work pension that I've taken and I'm trying to invest it in sensible things. So I know nothing about finance or economics. So I made it my my job to learn about this. So I've learned a lot about that. So that's taken, sometimes that took 4 hours a day. So that was interesting. I read books. I'm trying to enjoy the time off before I think, you know, I do know that come November, when the dark nights come, I may well think, okay, the summer's over, buddy. What are you going to do with your time? So we'll see. As they say, I'm not dead yet.
That's awesome. Certainly not. Bill, it was kind of a series of stock questions that we always land the plane of these conversations with.
Fire away.
We have covered a lot, so if there's any overlap, please feel free to say so, and we can just kind of move on. Most challenging moment so far, and how have you been able to overcome it?
Oh, blimey. In my kind of journalism, there are so many challenging moments, but probably covering war is the most challenging thing because so much is focused on your own survival, and you often have so little time for the journalism itself. So I've been at times embedded with troops from the UK, the US, other nations. For example, the first night of the Iraq War in 2003, I was with the Royal Marines, 4-2 Commando, being helicoptered into to Iraq, except that the helicopter that was meant to take us had crashed a few minutes earlier, killing all on board. And we eventually got into a replacement helicopter and we landed and we were in the wrong place. And, you know, all of those things really do test so much. Because whatever you thought the plan was going to be, you know, the plan never survives contact with the enemy, as we say. So you're challenged, to survive, but also then, how am I going to do my job? I'm in a place detached from the lines. We've landed in the wrong place. I have a story to tell, a huge story about the first British and US casualties in this war. And I have no pictures. I can't tell the story because there are no visuals to tell it with. I think to answer your question, war situations in general are always so trying. Whether it's with the Brits, the Americans in Afghanistan, there were many, many. And it's not just moments when you're under fire. I mean, those are very, very dodgy moments as well. But I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's probably a catch-all.
I'm really glad you brought it up, because one of the things that I did want to ask was, how do you personally do your best to deal with that level of trauma, or as much as possible stop that trauma from sticking to you?
Yeah. So I think I referred to being lucky earlier on. I think I am lucky in that I've managed to sort of compartmentalize what has happened. I don't get flashbacks. Mm-hmm. I never luckily suffered from terrible dreams, waking up in the middle of the night screaming. I think truthfully, I've never been absolutely traumatized by something that I saw. I mean, I covered a massacre once where I counted 42 people lying dead in ditches, headless, butchered. So I've seen terrible things, but it has never affected me too much. I wouldn't say that I've never had a form of PTSD. I think on one or two occasions I did. I've been, you know, certainly when people talk about PTSD victims being angry with their families, you know, quick-tempered, irritated with the world, you know, I have ticked all those boxes in the past. But I think in general, I've been very lucky in that I've got wonderful family, wonderful friends. We can talk about it. Yes, journalists do sometimes drink to excess, and it's very bad if that gets out of control. But you know, we have learned sometimes to decompress. We laugh. Often there's black humor. You know, like Northern Ireland, quite famous for black humor, and in the Troubles, boy, there was a lot of black humor. Yeah. So oddly, that can help as well. But funnily enough, I was talking to a cameraman who is from Northern Ireland about scenes that we had seen in Beslan when about 1,000 children and teachers were taken hostage by Islamic militants in Dagestan, and about 350 of them were killed. And we saw some terrible, terrible scenes. And just last week, this guy and I were talking about that and remembering it still vividly. And you can draw on something like that quite easily, but it doesn't overwhelm me, I suppose. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll never forget some of those scenes. They're imprinted, you know, they're burned on my brain and on my retina, but they don't come to me in terrible ways. So yeah. I've been lucky that it's manageable.
It's interesting. Flip side of the coin then, what about the most successful moment?
Oh, gosh. Sometimes when you do a great story and it gets through and it gets on air, you know, you manage to feed it in time from difficult circumstances and it reaches air. And maybe someone that you really respect sends you a quick message saying, that was just great. I mean, those are moments when you punch the air. Mm. I've been lucky enough that there've been lots of those. I mean, there've been lots of mistakes and failures as well, sure. Believe me. But yes, those are particularly happy moments, especially if you can then go off and have a, you know, glass of wine after it, and sort of celebrate, you know, one success. But then you've got to get back on the horse the next day. I mean, that is the funny thing about journalism, that, you know, you might be hugely successful on a Monday and you might be a complete flop on a Tuesday, because actually Tuesday was the bigger story and you screwed up. So, you know, if you do mess up, you've got an opportunity the next day to put it right. The other thing very briefly that I would say is, you know, being a journalist is interesting, but when you make a mistake, usually it can be rectified or nobody dies. I mean, if you're a surgeon and you just make one little cut into a vein, or you make one tiny mistake, that can cost someone their life. And I've always had a huge amount of respect for those kinds of people who have a far greater responsibility on their shoulders. I mean, yes, I take my responsibilities very, very seriously. Tell the truth, or as close to whatever the truth is that you can. Stick to the facts, be fair, but, you know, be objective insofar as you can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, at the end of the day, we are lucky, because if we get something wrong, we can put it right. And in many walks of life, that's just not possible.
Absolutely. If you could take anyone, dead or alive, out for a glass of wine or a cup of coffee from Northern Ireland, who would you take? Where would you take them? And why?
Oh, from Northern Ireland, you've narrowed it down such a lot. Oh, Lord. Blimey. The actor Liam Neeson, I've always liked. In fact, he and I were in a short film that was broadcast on BBC Northern Ireland once. It was an excerpt of a play by the playwright Graham Reid, Liam Neeson and Stephen Ray. And that was really before Liam Neeson was even a household name in Northern Ireland.
Never Liam Neeson.
Before he became Liam Neeson, that's right. That's exactly
he was
right.
A lyric man, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. And I interviewed him when I was based in the US and when Schindler's List came out, and he was Oscar Schindler. And I think he's had a fantastic career. I'm not sure about the last few bits of it when, you know, he's obviously just decided to be the action, kind of action hero.
Sure, yeah.
And clearly, you know, he's got into a bit of trouble once or twice for things he said, but maybe he would be interesting. I mean, I've always, you know, loved sports, so I was thinking Rory McIlroy and stuff, but I don't know enough about golf, and, you know, as a Northern Ireland guy, kind of proud when anyone from Northern Ireland does fantastically, so yeah. Proud of his career. I love football. I've had the privilege of talking to Pat Jennings plenty of times. George Best, sadly, is no longer with us, who was obviously a hero to many of us who grew up in the 70s. That's not great. It's going to have to be Liam Neeson.
It's awesome. No, I love that. It's a great answer. Final question then, Bill.
Yeah.
It's the classic. It's the ultimate cliche, but you know what? You just can't get away from it. If you could go back in time to, say, an 18-year-old Bill who's just finished secondary school and he's on his way to university, what sort of things would you say to him if he had a couple of minutes of his time?
It's going to be all right. I mean, I think we're all a bit angst-ridden at 18 in all sorts of ways. You know, we're either in love with somebody that we can't go out with, or we're worried about, you know, which university we're going to get into or what career we're going to have, or it is a difficult time between 17 and 23, just to pick an age range. I think when I got to 40, I think I just relaxed and I was happy in my own skin. Also, I think work hard. I think hard work really, really does pay off. So I would tell the 18-year-old, I mean, I was a, you know, pretty hardworking kid at a good school and really wanted to seize opportunities. So definitely I'd say, you know, things will work out, but work hard and enjoy life. Just surf the wave if you can. I had no clear career path, but just thought when I started to do radio journalism, this is fun. And it kept being fun. And, you know, when I joined ITN and I started being a foreign correspondent, there were difficult times, but boy, it was fun. So I think I would also tell the 18-year-old, look, you know, just relax, work hard. And if you do, it won't just be satisfying, it can be a lot of fun, and you'll have a lot of laughs along the way with a lot of great people. And that's pretty much what life has been for me. I mean, I go back to the crude fact that I have been very, very lucky.
Bill, there's a bonus question we throw in, and I'll be honest, sometimes it flops. And I always just leave it at the end because there's that take back.
Yeah.
And usually requires quite a long pause.
Okay.
What's the kindest thing that someone's ever done for you?
Oh, the kindest thing. I'll tell you a very quick story, which is the first thing that comes to my mind, and it's probably not the kindest.
we live for the initial story. That's where the gold really is. And it's different every time. You know, I could ask you six different times with six different answers.
So once when I was working in BBC Northern Ireland, I did overnight shifts, and I was working overnight all week. And at the end of it, on Friday morning, I knew I was going to go to Greece for 2 or 3 weeks.
Epic.
So I left the BBC newsroom, went back to my flat, grabbed my bag and headed off to the airport. And I got to the airport and I booked a flight. And the best thing was I booked a budget flight from London to Athens. So it was costing me so little. But first I had to get from Belfast to London. So I got to Belfast airport and sat down, having checked in, all great. And I fell asleep.
Oh,
and I not only missed the first Belfast to London flight, but I missed the second Belfast to London flight.
No.
And woke up just in time to beg my way onto the third flight. And I got to Heathrow and I had something like 3 hours to get to Gatwick to get the plane. And I knew if I went on public transport, I wasn't going to make it. So I thought I'd try and get a taxi here. So I got a taxi and I told the driver what had happened. And the fare would have been something like, I think it was £65 from memory, which was a lot of money in 1983. And I wrote him a check because I didn't have the cash. And I luckily got the plane by the skin of my teeth.
Wow.
And he never cashed the check.
Wow.
So that was just a small act of kindness. And I was reminded of it this week by the story of the Jamaican athlete who had scraped through his national trials, came third to go to the Olympics in Tokyo, scraped through his heat, got through the semi-final and got into the final. And he left. He tried to get a car to take an Olympic car, but they were all booked up. So he took a bus, a coach, to what he thought was the Olympic Stadium, except it wasn't. It was the aquatics venue.
Oh, no.
And he arrived there with something like 3 hours to go before the final and realized he was in the wrong place and he had no money. So he asked a volunteer and the volunteer gave him a 10,000 yen note and said, get a car, get a taxi. And he got to the stadium just in time for his check-in, did his warm-up, went out, and he won the gold medal.
No, he didn't.
So a couple of days later, he went back to find the volunteer, and he found her. She was a woman from Eastern Europe, wasn't Chinese, actually. And she recognized him, but she didn't know what had happened. And he said, I've got something for you. And he pulled out of his bag the gold medal. And she couldn't believe it. And it's a very, very touching thing. And it's just a small act of kindness that she didn't, she knew what she was doing. She was giving him a lot of money. But look what came of it. And that gold medal would never have been but for her act of kindness. So I look back at my taxi driver, who I had no way of tracing. But yeah, he never cashed his money. He never cashed his check.
Well, Bill, that is a gorgeous way to end.
You're very welcome.
Thanks so much for taking the time to do this.